Hello, world. It's Mike Traverso with the Friends That Code podcast, where I get a chance to showcase some amazing people I know that just happen to write code for a living. Folks, today I have the pleasure of speaking with a developer that I met a few weeks ago at a developer conference slash bootcamp graduation. He gave a presentation that really blew me away, mostly because the presentation was centered on video games and how that got him into wanting to write code. And that really resonated with me because that's how I got into software development. So today's guest went to the University of South Florida for graphic design, but finished with a degree in fine and studio arts. Now, after graduating, he's been a professional photographer for the past 5 years. And to pick up some extra cash, he got himself a job at Suncoast Developers Guild, starting off as an enrollment specialist, helping others get their careers in software development going. You see, today's guest has always been into video games, and I guess you can say especially Nintendo games. He's been a big fan of following the modding and homebrew communities, learning how to tweak your existing game into something the original developers never even thought of. So, for example, what would Mario Kart be like with Thomas the Tank Engine as a playable character? Right, there you go. So while working at the Suncoast Developers Guild, he decided it was time to enroll himself. And while there, learning how to code his own apps, he became proficient in HTML, CSS, JavaScript, React, C#, .NET, and SQL. So naturally, with all of those skills, there was really only one way to go with his final project, an app that helped you remember the combos to Super Smash Brothers. And it was that presentation of that app a few weeks ago that I met today's guest. Nintendo enthusiast, video game lover, graphic designer, photographer, app developer, and spanking new software developer, ladies and gentlemen, today's guest is Kento Kawakami. Kento, thanks for hanging out today. How you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me. Super excited.
Excellent. Excellent. No, I'm really excited to have you here again. We really don't know each other, but it was that presentation that you gave that, you know, I don't know how many other people kind of got given you feedback on that, but that was such a cool presentation and just kind of a walkthrough kind of not just your life, but then kind of the whole progression of your project and how you got to this app that you've built. And I want to talk about that. But I want to kind of help people understand a little bit more about you. And you're a photographer now, right? And I don't mean like you've got a camera and some free time. You're legit. You've got a dark room in your home, right?
I do. If you can see it in the video, it's back here. But yes, I do. I do. Analog photography is kind of where my passion is. You know, when I go into college at USF and studying photography, I took this one class called Alternative Process, which basically takes the traditional darkroom process and into a whole nother level by like making your own emulsions and stuff like that. So that's kind of the stuff that I was really, really into. But nowadays I'm doing a lot of analog photography for fun.
Cool. And so yeah. What do you shoot with? What's your equipment?
So my main go-to camera is a 1953 Rolleiflex. It's one of those twin lens cameras that you may have seen in some movies where it has two lenses, one on top and one on the bottom. And instead of like having it up to your face for the viewfinder, you like looking down. So I use that a lot, and I have a 35mm camera that I use like very casually. Actually, I have it back here. If I wanted to show it to you.
Wow.
So you may have
seen it. We're gonna get
some
photos of this and put them up on in the show notes. But this is a really cool camera, folks.
Yeah. This is a Rolleiflex. This is a twin lens camera I was talking about. And you can look inside, you know, that through the little viewfinder up here.
Cool.
But yeah, I like to do a lot of street photography with this camera. And I got, if you go in my back room, I got tons of cameras back there.
Excellent. I'm the same way with old phones and old computer equipment. Ooh. So I've collect all kinds of, my wife calls it crap. So
it's not crap.
It's an easier way to classify it.
Sometimes you just, you know, we all like to collect things. And I used to be really big into collecting a lot of things. And I think I collect a little bit of vinyl, not too much. I started one and I wanted, my friend got me a record player, and you know, the sound on it is just incomparable, right? Like with just listening to something from a Spotify or whatever. It's just, there's something true and like natural about that physical sound that comes from a vinyl. And that's like the same exact feeling that I have towards film photography. It's just, it gets really easy to get carried away when you're shooting digital, when you have memory cards that are 64 gigabytes, 32 gigabytes, it's huge, right? That can store thousands and thousands of photos, as opposed to when you're shooting in film, you're stuck with a roll, like whether that's 12 on that camera that I just showed you, that's 12 pictures per roll. My 35 millimeter can take like 36 photos, right, per roll. So that's different, worlds apart from having a camera that can take thousands versus like a few.
Right. And so you also, you've got a side hustle, right? Where you do, you photograph weddings, you take professional headshots.
Yeah.
So I imagine then if you're using analog cameras, like you've really got to pick your moment, right?
So when I'm working professionally,
okay,
I don't bring it with me. Yeah, so that's a huge difference between how I approach photography is there's the professional side of things and then there's the personal side of things, and which we'll talk a little bit more about why I'm moving away from the professional aspects of photography. But when you're doing professional photography, whether I'm doing headshots or weddings or events or whatever it may be, you would be using a digital camera, or I would be.
I was going to say that I can't imagine too many brides out there would be welcome to seeing, oh, you can only take 12 photos on that camera. Okay, sure.
There's actually funny story is that there are a lot of photographers today that actually still shoot film shoot weddings on film. Not the entire wedding. We call these people, call these photographers hybrids, because what they do is they'll take like normal, mediocre, just everyday candid photos on a digital camera. And if they wanted something more posed and more higher quality, they'll bring in the film, because there's just something about the film look that you can replicate to a degree with digital, but it's just not the same. And it's just one of those things that I think a lot of the top wedding photographers in the industry are doing nowadays. And they are a lot of times shooting on medium format film.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I've seen just a few of your photos, because I mean, I've come across your website and I've seen some of the photos that you've taken. And obviously, you know, you could see those. But then I've seen like your Twitter profile photo, and like that definitely looks analog, right?
It is. Yeah.
And you know, so, and it's just a really cool photo, and we're going to post Kento's Twitter profile URL over there, so you can take a look at his, first of all, you follow him on Twitter. He's always got cool stuff, especially if you're into, you know, video games or Super Smash Brothers. And we'll get into his app in a second, but also, sure, you know, just to take a look at what you're talking about in terms of what does an analog photo look like? It's helpful because, you know, on a podcast, we can't really show analog photo looks like. So, you know, well, you can kind of get a sense for what that would look like.
Yeah.
And again, I mentioned before, like you've traveled a lot and you've taken a lot of photos. This is your hobby is to take the Rolleiflex with yours or your other cameras with you and take these analog photos. What's been the most like fascinating thing or visually stimulating thing that you've come across in your travels?
So I got two places in mind, sure. I took these trips both of them last year. Okay. One was in Colorado and another was in Boston, and those two places stand out very vividly to me. Because Colorado, if you've ever been, you know, it's just absolutely stunning and breathtaking. And I went on a backpacking trip, on a solo backpacking trip by myself, and spent 4 days in the wilderness with just me and my camera and you know, some equipment to take care of myself out there. I backpacked to the top of or crossed the Maroon what do you call it? The national park that I went to was called the Maroon Bells National Park.
Okay.
Actually, I don't think it's a national park. I think it's just a park. They had there's a backpacking trail that you can take that goes over four mountain passes. So it's called the Four Pass Loop, because it go over four mountain passes. And then the first one that I went through was the first, it's called the West Maroon Pass. And just climbing up from the very top and looking down from the mountain up top, it's just like a whole like exhilarating experience in that. So that stands out to me very vividly. And just being by myself was, had a lot of time for you to reflect and stuff like that. And then I also bring up Boston because, I grew up in a city back in Japan. I lived there for, 10 years of my life, and born and raised. But, when I went to Boston, like I kind of, it was just like a very nostalgic feeling of what it's like to live in a city. But when I went to Boston and visited Massachusetts up there, I went on and just did a bunch of street photography just for myself. And I did a little bit of series. And I don't know, there's just something about the nature of the city itself, the people, the skyline and the park. It's just a lot of characteristics to it.
Yeah, and Boston's one of those, it's a large city that's very condensed. Yeah. You know, Tampa, for example, we've got a big downtown, a lot of big buildings, but then it's so spread out. Like Tampa's one of those cities where it's just so spread out. And then there's this bleed over into St. Pete. And, you know, so, yeah, I get exactly what you're talking about, is that when you get to these cities like Boston, New York, you know, L.A., like it's very condensed. Everything is kind of right there. And it just keeps kind of growing from this epicenter.
Yeah.
As opposed to being kind of all stretched out in all different directions, like Tampa would be. You mentioned Colorado, and you mentioned how breathtaking that was. And I just want to share, I've been to Colorado once. I've been to Denver, fantastic city, great food, great experiences. But I'll say this, if you're not really interested in the whole backpacking thing, you can walk down certain streets in Denver and look to the left and like, okay, there's the Colorado Rockies. And then just be like, okay, I'm done. But it's still breathtaking because you get those visuals and you're just like, wow, it's amazing.
If you're in Colorado or Denver per se, and you don't go into the Rockies, you're missing out.
Yeah. Like I said, it was a fantastic trip that I took. I didn't go anywhere near that. I was only there for a few days anyway, but still, the photos that I would see friends of mine taking of hikes that they would go on, it was breathtaking. One of them, I think they came across a moose.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, didn't know that you could still do that.
I promise you, I there was probably a bear in my campsite when I was sleeping one of those nights in the backpacking trip. Because it's not like one of those deer little footsteps. It's like click, 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 click. It was like a thump, 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 you know, like,
oh, man.
It was like a big guy. So
yeah, no, that's definitely not encouraging a lot of folks to go backpacking into the woods in Denver.
If you're adventurous, you know, by all means, it's a lot of fun.
All right, cool. So, you know, I mentioned, so you talked about a little bit about your travels, and you started off at the University of South Florida, and you went in kind of studying graphic design. But you graduated with a degree in fine and studio arts. Mm-hmm. What was that experience like for you?
Yeah, so I actually went through two different campuses. I initially started off in USF St. Pete, and they had their graphic design program, which is they don't really teach more of like graphic design and what we think of in like UI, UX, more of the commercial side of things. It's more conceptual and art-based. And but graphic design was just a medium. And it was a very competitive program to get into. I took some of the pre-graphic design courses. That's what I did for 2 years. I was taking those courses. And, you know, I was very, very inclined into design because it's just some of the things that I was very interested in back in elementary, or not even, well, I started with drawing. And then in middle school, I started learning, playing around with like Photoshop and using some of the Adobe tools and started to understand the elements and principles of design. And then so I went to go to school and formally get educated. And eventually, I'm not exactly sure what happened, but I've kind of lost touch with the graphic design like career, I think. I just didn't really see myself doing it. But I did enjoy the work that I did create. And at the time is where I was really, really reinforcing my love for photography. And so I was like, maybe I should just switch to like a photography degree or something, or take some courses in photography and whatever that degree is. And so I ended up switching to Tampa after 2 years, halfway throughout the, or a little over halfway actually, because I graduated in 3.5. But yeah, I eventually took studio arts, took a lot of other courses like sculpture, ceramics, drawing, painting, etc. You name it, right? Right. But the one that I focused on was photography. And during my photography classes, that was around the time where I was really, really experimenting with other mediums in photography and really fell in love. And as my final like graduating thing that I was doing in college was I did a little art show with a friend of mine, my friend George, if he's listening. He and I did a duo show, and you know, he did the sculptures and I did these prints called the tricolor gum bichromate prints. And I won't get into too much into detail, but essentially each of those prints take about 40 to 44 hours to create, just one print. Okay, and I made 44 of them. Wow. And obviously I was able to create it faster because I made them in batches and I did a whole art exhibition on it. But this is just to say that I've been an artist in the past, primarily focusing on photography, but I've also had, you know, experience in graphic design, which you'll see a lot in a lot of the works that I do in anything that I do.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, speaking of like, your app is incredibly polished. You know, especially because you see a lot of folks that come out of a boot camp, sometimes it's not polished. It's more, you know, hey, this works, and it's just fundamental.
Yeah,
exactly. You know, you talk about creativity and creating, and I think a lot of, you know, software development is creating. Now, how do you go from a studio arts degree and being an artist, right? How do you go from that to wanting to write code? Tell me about this journey.
Yeah, so you've probably heard a little bit about it, which is that growing up, I played a lot of video games, more specifically a lot of Nintendo games, and that I think during that time was where it really occurred to me. I was like, oh, I really want to learn how to do all these things. Like, what, like when you're creating modifications for games like that, like there's a lot of technology that goes in behind all of that, you know. At the time, I didn't know how it was done. I just know that there are these really smart people creating these really smart softwares with these really smart and thought out mods, right? And I've been really interested in doing that on the side. This is like a personal thing. And the most I've gotten in the past in creating something like that were like making custom models on like Cinema 4D or whatever, for like custom models for Mario Kart. Like, I've done that before, okay, but I didn't really do any of the coding. So like, okay, well, how did I get to coding from design? Is that I think it all just comes down to this idea of creating. You know, it's such a cliche answer, really, but I think it's so true. You know, well, I think a lot of the people who really have a passion in programming is because they have this need that they need to create something. And it's just like photography, it's another medium. And I just like experimenting with mediums, you know, as long as it's not clay. I don't like clay.
Well, clay's, it's just a pain in the neck to clean up. So I don't blame you there.
I don't like the mess that comes with clay.
But you actually had, you were big into Super Mario Kart, I was reading.
Mm-hmm.
And you actually, you know, there was one person in particular, like, I think his name was Mr. Bean 35,000.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you just kind of followed this guy and what he was doing. And I like that story that you were telling during the presentation, where you just kind of followed this one person and you were testing and then,
yeah,
you were learning kind of how, like, how, what, you know, what went into it and just kind of get it. Like, so for me, I was never an artist. When I was growing up, I used to draw a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But then I kind of realized like it would be very hard for me to make money doing art. And because I didn't know anybody else that did it. And so there was never any kind of encouragement down that path,
mm-hmm.
But I did know that people made money writing software. So I was like, okay, what can I do that's also artistic? So I said, I'm going to write, software. And then I got to college and said, nope, I'm going to be an engineer. And then I took my first material science class and I said, no, this is not going to work, folks. I need to change my major here and do it quickly. And so that's when I got into software development and writing code. And when I talked to my professor, talked about our senior project and said, we want to do a video game. The answer was absolutely not. And I kind of then said, okay, well, look, this is what's involved in making a video game. It's not just playing them. It's you have to write code for this, and there's a lot of it. And then not only do you have to write the code, but then you have to have the art and the music and all the stuff that goes along with it. So then that's when I convinced him, and we wrote a little game called Alex in Demented Land. I think I still have that somewhere.
You programmed it.
Programmed it, and then I forget what the app was. I don't want to say Bender because it wasn't Bender. It was some kind of like modeling software where you can like create characters with. And so what we did was kind of we would create the character, put the characters in a pose, and then kind of snapshot it, and then take that and use that as kind of our and like build a whole bunch of sprites off of that. Yeah. So these 3D models that we were building. We would like, we didn't know how to make them animated in 3D at the time. And we just said, let's just make this simple and do a 2D. And so we'll have sprites where we can like flip. It's almost like a flipbook, experience.
Right.
So make them look like they're moving.
Right. I'm so curious in what the process of creating a game is like. I've never done it before. I've always been interested in it. I remember before I started working at SDG, I was thinking about taking a internship over at Blizzard. And for those of you who don't know, Blizzard is a company that creates games like World of Warcraft, Overwatch, Diablo, and I think Dota. No, they don't make Dota. I forgot. They make some other games, but, they're over in Irvine, California. And I was like super interested in like just getting into game development, but, that never happened.
It's tough. And it's also a hard industry to get into, especially if you don't know someone. So when I got out of school, I'm getting full blown. All right. I just created a game. Let's go make some more games.
Right.
Who's hiring? And then no one, you know, cause it was, so I went into work for a bank and did that for 10 years and said, no, there's not a lot of need for visual creativity.
Right.
A lot of it is enterprise, and it's like, okay, well, you can have discussions on where you put a button or what color the button is, but no one really cares about animation. Yeah. No one really cares about that kind of stuff. It's just, where are these buttons going to go?
Yeah.
All right. So you go and you enroll into the Suncoast Developers Guild's bootcamp. What are you studying while you're there?
What are we studying while we're going through the bootcamp?
Yeah.
So the primary thing they teach us is how to build a full stack app, right? And the technologies that we're working with, as you introduced earlier, is C# and .NET backend, right? We learn .NET Core and how to do stuff like migrations and how to work with databases. So in our case, we learn Postgres and tying that all and creating an API application, right? And bringing in some of the front end technologies using React, right? And kind of bringing it all together is essentially like what we've learned, which you know really helped me a lot because I think my challenges that I had as a developer and like coming trying to learn to be a developer like as younger is how to set up something. Like I think that's the best way I can put it. It's like how do you set up a project? Because I have no idea how to set up a project And Gavin, who's our instructor, who was able to, you know, step by step how to build it from the beginning, from your computer that has nothing installed to everything you need to have to an end product like Smash Combos, is kind of the goal of what Suncoast is supposed to teach. And honestly, they did a really good job at it.
Yeah, no, and I saw a bunch of the demos that day, and all of them look incredibly well put together. All of them worked, which was sometimes you don't always see at the end of a boot camp, but they all had a lot of polish on them as well. So it was really cool to see. And that happens over the course of what, 8 weeks?
They're 12 weeks.
12
three
weeks.
Months. Okay. Yeah.
Right. So in 3 months, you become proficient in HTML, CSS, JavaScript, React, C#, .NET, and SQL. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a lot for a boot camp. So my favorite part about your journey, though, and this is another part of your career that kind of resonates with me because similar kind of paths here is that correct me if I'm wrong, you were taking classes and at the same time, you're also a teaching assistant at the same time.
No. So to clarify that, I'm teaching assistant now. Okay. And so SDG is very nice enough to let me teach while making a little bit of money on the side until I look for a job.
Sure.
So I was going through the course, you know, full time. My relationship with SDG started off as an enrollment specialist, right? And doing that for, I think, almost 2 years. And then once I decided I was going to take the program, you know, I stopped, I quit, and I was like, I'm ready to do this. Took the program for 3 months. And then now I'm just kind of in this place where I can finally find a job that I've been wanting to get, which is a developer job. But until then, they're allowing me to TA, which honestly is like a great opportunity for me. To be able to first teach our students. our instructor, Gavin, has had me and one other TA who's working with us kind of take over our little review session that we do at 3 o'clock, which kind of reviews a lot of the concepts that they covered in the prior lecture they had in the morning. And kind of taking it on ourselves and kind of doing this live review, like doing live coding in front of our students and being able to explain the concepts and knowledges that we've learned. And it really helps because teaching really helps out with reinforcing what you know.
Yes. But yes, 100%. And that's something that I've talked about a lot in some of my talks is that, you know, for folks out there who are listening, you know, if you're interested in learning something, teach it. And it makes it kind of makes no sense, right? Like, how would you teach something you don't know? Well, because you get out there and you learn it, because everybody has this fear of looking silly or stupid in front of a bunch of other people. So what do you do naturally? Well, you go out there and you learn it really well before you go out there and start trying to teach it. Yeah. So one of the best ways to learn something, like Kento was saying, is to teach it.
Yeah.
It makes no sense, but it totally works.
Totally, 100% agree. Like you said, I think when you're going, when you are teaching, should prevent yourself from looking kind of, you know, not like pretend like you don't know something, or if you come across like you don't know something, you know, you're going to try to avoid that as much as you can. So you're going to sit the night before and be like, what is this? Yes. What is object-oriented programming? What is interfaces in C#? And like, and you're like, try to be able to communicate those ideas to students. Something happens in your mind. You just learn it a lot better.
Yeah. Cause I was a TA for a little bit and I've given some talks. The last thing you want to see when you're giving a talk or you're teaching someone something is like that, those blank stares, because like the more blank stares you get, it's like you're getting an F.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, so it's not fun. So you do, like you said, you kind of hammer it home, make sure you totally understand it. And then you do it often enough. I mean, you become an expert in it. So that's really cool. I know you went to a 4-year school and then you went to a boot camp, and they're two totally kind of different topics, but you know, what was your preference for learning?
So there's pros and cons for both, right? And I would say that for where I am currently in my life, and I'm 27 years old, it's been a while since I've graduated from college, that I feel like now I'm more in a place where I'm okay to go to school because I've gotten some experiences in my life to know what I wanted to go to school for. Maybe if I was just starting off, like back when I graduated from high school, maybe a boot camp would have been a right place for me to kind of accelerate on a particular skill, whatever that may be, whatever trade you decide to go to, in this case, programming, right? And focus on that and kind of let your life do its thing and try to figure out what that is. And I think there's this idea that, especially, when I was in high school, I went through the IB program, the International Baccalaureate program, and they teach like at a college level, and all the teachers are like, oh, you gotta go to college, you gotta do this and this, and there's this like pressure that you need to go to college. All the other students are going to college, so you need to go to college. I wish I didn't fall under that pressure as much. I wish I would have taken some more time to really understand what it is that I wanted to learn before I go into college, because one's expensive, right? Yeah. It's really expensive. I'm still paying off my debt for my time at USF. But But when it comes to accelerated learning, I think it all depends on where you are in your life. And I definitely learned a lot more while we're going through the boot camp. But if I wanted to go and learn about the theory of why something works, right, that's probably why you would go to college. So I don't know. It really depends on what your goals are. But for me, I think I'm at a point where I actually would like to go back to school because I kind of wanted to get a computer science degree now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Cool.
Well, I bet you, I would imagine, though, at this point, you could probably go back and get a master's degree in computer science, right? I mean, because...
Is that how that works?
Honestly, I have no idea how it works. I imagine if you pay them enough money, they'll let you do whatever you want.
Mm.
That's how it works.
I'm not sure.
I always thought that Lori Loughlin got in trouble for that, so I don't really know.
I don't know. I always thought you had to get a bachelor's in computer science before you go in to get a master's into something or a master's in the computer.
Yeah, but I think because you have a bachelor's degree already, getting a master's degree is kind of a next step, and you're just kind of changing that. Because a lot of times too, they do an introduction course at the master's level, and I never really understood those.
Mm.
Why would you do it? But in any event, I don't want to digress too much from that. But I do think that's really valid though. A couple of points you make there is one, not knowing what you want to do and taking a boot camp, which might be a little bit less expensive than, you know, starting off in college, and then really kind of understanding that, and you get to learn how to implement. So you may not necessarily understand all of the theory behind it, but you understand how to implement it. And I think a lot of times most of the folks that are going to school for bachelor's degrees in computer science, they want to learn how to implement. And it's the theory that I think bogs folks down and they kind of give up. I mean, I saw it when I went to school, like a few friends who just kind of like, you know, disappeared one day. And then the second point that you were making too about, you know, going back to school for stuff is another great thing, because you can always go back. Like, people in education will always take your money to teach you more things. That's something that and the earth will spin are two givens that you can count on.
Yeah.
So now I want to talk about the end of your boot camp.
Right? Sure.
So you've got your final project. I want to talk about that.
Okay.
So one of the things that got me into software development, like I said before, was my love of video games. And when I was a kid, one of my favorites was Street Fighter II. The first time I saw that game, I was in a comic book store, and I fell in love with the artwork, the animation, the music, but I was awful at it, you know, because... Again, I had no idea. I was tapping buttons. I had no idea. I was wondering what the heck the other person was doing, like how they were pulling off these moves, like the Hadouken move.
Yeah.
Like
the half circle or whatever it is. I don't remember.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if I had no idea how to pull that off. And then what was the Shoryuken move where Ryu and Ken can jump up in the air and punch and spin at the same time? No, you just have no idea. It's nothing about that, or nothing about playing the NES and Super Nintendo. Like, none of that kind of made it seem, oh, this makes sense to do this move. Like, none of it. So, you know, and they don't print any of the moves on the arcade cabinet, because it's an arcade cabinet.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So they're not doing that. So skip forward a few years, you have Super Smash Brothers. It comes out for Nintendo, and it is probably notorious. I think it's notorious for being difficult, right? It's one of these other games where they don't really print the instructions for the characters.
Yeah, I would say that, honestly, a lot of fighting games are difficult. And Smash is a very different kind of game. It's a different kind of fighting game. It has a different approach. I think the inspiration behind how Smash works is how Sumo works, which makes it very different from how other fighting games, where you have a little health bar and it's the main goal of the game is to get that health bar to zero. Smash is not like that. Smash is who can knock the opponent off the stage earlier than the other player. Like it becomes a game about that. But Smash itself does have its own challenges. Like you said, there's I think what makes it really difficult is the fact that there's 80 something characters.
Yeah.
And trying to learn how to play all of them, if you're a type of person like to play all of them or some of them or just one of them, can get really challenging for sure.
You mentioned, you know, when you just made a comparison between Super Smash Brothers and Sumo, and I'd never made that connection before, and you totally blew my mind. Like I never, and now it totally makes sense. Like,
yeah.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah.
So, all right. So this is just Nintendo being Nintendo with this next game, right? So your app helps solve some of that problem though. Mm-hmm. So tell us tell me about your app. Tell us all about your app.
Oh my goodness. You're in for a treat here today. there's a quite a story that goes behind this app and where it's gone and where it's been and so on. If you got a boot camp story, a boot camp final project story, this is probably the one. So
I'll tell you what, tell us first what inspired you to build the app. Then we'll get into what it is.
So I essentially made the app because I, first of all, play a lot of Super Smash Brothers, and I watch a lot of tutorials on how to play certain characters and so on. And it's always been challenging to find like a central hub of information of how to play characters or certain concepts about the game. A lot of these informations are kind of all over the place, right? They're on Reddit, they're on Smashboards, they're on Discord. There's a bunch of communities way back then. There used to be like tons of different communities. I think a lot of them kind of narrowed down into Reddit I think it's usually like Reddit or Discord. But now you got a problem with Discord where there's a Discord server. If you're not aware of Discord, it's kind of like Slack, how you have your own little Slack server, right? Okay. For your own company. Discord has their own little Discord servers that you can create. And a lot of the times characters will have their own Discord servers. So there's a ton of Discord servers, right? For the 80 something characters. And there's like centralized Discords like, I think Reddit has their own Discord server or whatever. So, but having all this information just scattered all about gets really, really hard to track down. Some are on YouTube and wherever, right? So I first grew inspiration from, I think, primarily a lot of the Dragon Ball Z fighting games, where they actually have combos that are integrated into the game. And you can literally pause the game and you can see all the combos, like how to do the father and son Kamehameha or whatever, right? Like it shows you how to do all these things, and I have like little animations and button inputs and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, that's really, really cool. I really like that UI. How can I get something like that for Smash? Because Smash does not have anything like that. Smash is way more abstract. There's a lot of the things that you do aren't really implemented in the game. As a matter of fact, they're kind of, we call these people labbers, where they go into the training room and lab a certain character, like taking them to a science lab and trying to see what are some of the capabilities that these characters have.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So by going into very specifics, by going to like very specific elements like the frame data, like the hitboxes and all, like it gets really complicated. Because Smash is so abstract, a lot of these moves that you have aren't really concrete. And so you kind of had to go out and experiment. So I was like, well, why not just have a place where people can put all of this information that they've gathered into just this platform where you can upload a combo in the style that Dragon Ball Z had, which is that pause button menu, that little tiny UI that I was like, oh, I really like that. So that's kind of where the inspiration came from. And, you know, when you go through each of the combos for a character, it shows you, my app shows you a clip, a segment of a YouTube video and puts that on loop. So all you're worried about is not the entire video, but just that little section of the video that does the specific combo. So now you got this little UI, right, for Smash that's based on the browser and the web that you can refer to when you want to learn a certain character. So that's kind of how I came about it.
So your video and all of the move, like, you know, here's the buttons, here's the order in which to press them in. So that, like I said, when I saw that, I was just like, oh my God, this is amazing. Like they should have this for everything. Like this is what Nintendo should be printing and putting in the box when they ship these discs.
They should,
but they don't, unfortunately. And that's fortunately, that's how, you know, you got to creating Smash combos, and that's how we're talking today.
Yeah.
So it kind of worked itself out. and so, you know, I know you're just starting yourself along the software path, the software developer path. Mm-hmm. Do you see yourself getting into game development in the future?
Yeah.
Is that the next medium for you?
So maybe. So we talked about it a little bit earlier. I was like really interested in working for Blizzard in the past. It's actually great that we're learning C Sharp, right? In SDG, because C Sharp has a really, really nice engine that it built on Unity, right? We got Unity that's built on C Sharp. And Unity is an engine that builds a lot of games. I think a lot of Switch games are also built on the Unity engine as well. You know, you got things like the Unity or Unreal, and I think there's like a couple other ones that I can't remember off the top of my head. But I really wanted to learn Unity, and that's definitely like something I like to do on the side. If the opportunity presents for me to become a game developer someday, obviously, I definitely will take it. Definitely would. But it's one of those things where it's like a nice to do.
Okay.
But I don't know how, I don't know if it's actually going to happen. You know what I mean?
So let me tell you this. It's a lot easier than it looks.
Does it?
Oh yeah. Well, so I've built a few video games and I've released them independently.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, if you're looking to get into video game development, it's mm-hmm. hard to do it, especially on the East Coast. I feel like a lot more of those outfits are on the West Coast.
Yeah.
And again, you do have it is hard. It is it's like Silicon Valley. You've got to really kind of have an in.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, let's put it this way: it makes it a lot easier if you have an in, or you know someone that you can go in and get a job there.
Mm-hmm.
It's also hard because it's, you know, how are you making games? Like unless you're building games independently, mm-hmm. you really don't have a portfolio to show them.
Yeah.
It's just, hey, I know code. And so it's a little harder to kind of do that. But I'll say this, it is not hard to do if you have mm-hmm. the patience and the time. When you mentioned C Sharp and Unity, I was thinking, you know, there's also DirectX on the .net side,
mm-hmm.
Which... that was the first game I wrote was in DirectX, which was fun. So I hope to see you doing something with video games. And if you ever want to do a collab with a video game, happy to do stuff like that. Because like I said, we could do an iOS game together,
yeah.
or an Android game together. It would be fun.
I could see myself doing like mobile games. Like I remember there was a point in time where I really wanted to learn Swift and just kind of build for iOS. I don't know what happened. I just never really learned it ever since, but I wanted to, like, I remember when Flappy Bird came out. Remember that, the little game that goes like up and down and up and down, and it took off, and then somehow it just disappeared. I was like, man, if this guy can create this game like that takes off that much, like I think I can too. So I don't know.
And so that's one of the games that I cloned. Mine is called Here Fishy Fishy.
Oh, really?
Where you've got it? Yeah, you've got a. I mean, I don't want to get into it but it's. I don't even think it's still in the App Store anymore. iOS, you know, Apple's very. When they go to iOS and they jump versions of iOS, it's mm-hmm. like if you're not keeping up with them, they're like, hey, you're getting rid of your app out of the store. So you either update this app, okay, or we're taking it down.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Anyway, but we'll touch base maybe after and talk about that.
Yeah, definitely.
And so I want to, you know, you mentioned you're a TAing right now at the Suncoast Developers Guild, but you've got loftier goals in mind. And I want to try to help see if we can't maybe fill that. And I know maybe at the time of you know, this airs, mm-hmm. you've already got you know, a full-time paying position, which would be fantastic. But if you don't, you know, like I said, I know it's difficult to get any career in software development going. And I can't imagine what it's got to be like during a pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to make sure that folks out there understand if you are looking to hire somebody who has the C-sharp backend skills, the .NET experience, but also has HTML, the CSS, JavaScript, and React experience, and can also write a SQL statement, or 10 or 20, however many you need, Kento Kawakami, you should definitely take a look at his resume and put him on your staff. Nice guy, and he's got a lot of cool stories about video games and his projects. Definitely a hire. So just hire him. I mean, why am I talking to you?
Please.
It's 3:48 in the afternoon. You should be working somewhere. You should not be talking to me. So someone, please go hire Kento. Come on. You know, this is not, we should not be talking right now.
I'm having a lot of fun.
All right. So like I said, folks, hire Kento Kawakami. I will put his LinkedIn on the show notes along with his app. And actually, you know, while we're talking, his app, I'll put the link in the show notes, but it's smash-combos.herokuapp.com. And we'll have the link in the show notes for you to take a look at that. It is fantastic. Especially if you want to take a look at it and then challenge your friends to Super Smash Brothers. Oh boy. That would be so fun.
If you want to learn a character, by all means, Steve just came out from Minecraft. Steve is a playable character in the game. And I just added him to the app. Yep. I think like three people already posted a combo in there already. So. That's crazy.
Oh, you know, there was one other thing I wanted to mention too about your site. You've just implemented, and so it's not like, you know, mentioned before, you were just kind of sitting around cooking. Mm-hmm. You're not sitting around just doing nothing. You you're being a teaching assistant for a boot camp, which is difficult in its own right. But not only that, but you've also updated the site so that you can have a moderated version of having people post their own combos. So if folks are finding their own moves, right? I mean, you want to tell me about that?
Yeah. So after graduating, this app just kind of took off. I guess you can call it a good way, but it's got a lot of attention. And got a lot of attention on Reddit. And a lot of the people on Reddit were really, really nice and very supportive about my app. As a matter of fact, a bunch of developers who also play Smash like reached out to me. I think like 15 or 20 of them were like, hey, what can I do to contribute to this project? I really want to help you work on it, blah, blah, blah. Had all sorts of attention. And I was like, okay, well, that kind of gave me incentive to why not make this an open source project? So we made it an open source project.
Nice.
Figure out how to do that, how to write a contributing guideline, and how to set up this dev environment for other people and learning Git and all that kind of stuff, right? And on top of that, what happened was someone on Twitter discovered it. And when some malicious person in the app just took advantage of the fact that the app was bare bones. I just made it in like 2 weeks or whatever, right? At a boot camp. There's no moderation feature whatsoever. Decided they wanted to put some like inappropriate posts to be funny or whatever, and posted about it on Twitter. And when they posted it to Twitter, a bunch of people saw that post and came and raided my app. Internet being the internet, did internet things, and just they maxed out my YouTube API requests that I could have at a time or something like that, and just like flooded my site.
You had to take the site down.
Have to take the site down, and I had to go back to the drawing board, and I was like, okay, forget all these other features that everyone was asking me. Let me figure out how I can make this app usable right now, which was to create this reporting and moderating feature. And that was quite the process, because it's not just implementing the feature, but there was two other developers who was really interested in working with me. Out of all the people that reached out to me, there's two that really like followed up with me. And so I made a whole Discord server, right? And I made a whole server for the developers to communicate with, the users to communicate to the developers, the users just to hang out and do whatever. When the developers came and talked to me about this process, one of them was a lead dev from Australia. His name is Skittles. And then the other one, he goes by Sleep. He calls himself a sleeping dev. He's a junior developer from Austria. And the lead dev, Skittles, he was talking to me about like, oh, these are some really cool architectures you can implement onto your site. Let's try to do this. And so throughout the whole process, I've learned things like the CQRS pattern, how to implement Mediator, how to implement the clean architecture onto our backend, just completely revamping the backend from what it was, just a basic MVC model, right? Just a basic CRUD application that has this really nice little architecture. So we implemented that. I learned how to how to work with these like requests and responses and so on. And that, so we did that on the back end. And then on the front end, I was doing a lot of the work on React, because the two devs that I was talking about, they don't have any experience in a lot of React. So okay. I was carrying a lot of the weight there. So, but what ended up happening was that one, the lead dev, he just kind of gave us a direction on where to go. The other dev, from Austria, Sleep, he did a lot of the heavy work, heavy lifting on the back end, and I did a lot of the heavy lifting on the front end. So now there's this like collaboration happening, and it was like, it was just such an experience. And so now we finished the feature. It's up and running. People are able to use it again. I've recruited moderators. They're considered staff members in the Discord channel, and the app has been safe ever since.
Again, folks, if this story of how Kento had to go from, you know, a 2-week bootcamp project to now securing it and having a real app out there on the internet with moderators on it, I mean, that, after he's, you know, after learning how to secure it, implement all these different architectures, come on, man. someone hire Kento. All right. Kento, I want to ask some questions
for sure
that help look back on your career just a little bit. And I know it's just, it's your career is just kind of starting out, but I think these questions will still apply. Mm-hmm. I ask these for everybody. Okay. What have been some of the struggles that you've, or challenges that you've had and struggled with coming up as a software developer?
I think ultimately the resources, trying to find the right resources, because there's so many resources, right? The internet, the Google has so many things out there. But I think that kind of I think that's why I went to SDG, where I have a more, you know, a curriculum to follow to create this basic app. But if I were to not go to SDG and try to learn these on my own, I think the biggest challenge for me was like how to like set up a project like that. I think that was something that I've struggled with the most, and just having a something to follow, because there's just so many, like there's too many resources online, which is great, but it's also bad because you don't know which resources to look to, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And you also have you have someone to talk to and someone to ask a question of, who can answer you right away, as opposed to maybe waiting weeks or months before someone posts back on Stack Overflow.
I think it's really hard to like understand like what is a migration? What does that do? Right? Like if you're just learning and you don't know what, like it's meant to be used with a database to migrate, you know, your models into the data, like, how do you what does that even mean? Like, my past self wouldn't have known that, but I like having this curriculum to follow definitely really helped me with that. So that's like the biggest struggle.
Excellent. And that's leads me into my next question. What's something you wish you knew when you were younger? Mm. And it doesn't have to be the migration thing. I just kind of nice segue into this question.
I have a very broad way of answering this question.
Yeah, no, it doesn't have to be technical related.
Yeah, and I think it's just that I would tell myself to not focus too much on the future and just be more present with the present. a lot of it is because I think I used to get into this habit of just being so stressed out about trying to make my future this right way, whether that was I needed to be this particular photographer, or I needed to do web development, or I needed to do this for my career. And I think just getting yourself and trying to plan too much of your future kind of gets you out of touch with your presence. So I would tell myself, you know, what I wish I would have known was like, stop worrying about the future too much. It'll resolve itself. It's starting to resolve itself for me, right? And just kind of take things as it is. Enjoy the conversations you're having with the people. Put your phone down, you know.
Yes.
That's like a big thing. Enjoy the moment that you have with your loved ones and friends. And another thing is I'll probably like, don't be too hard on yourself. I think my past self has always been very, very hard on myself. And I would say, don't be too hard. Don't be too
hard. I agree. Yeah, I agree 100% with putting your phone away and don't being too hard on yourself, because there's plenty of other people that will be hard on you, you know, give you a hard time, and you know, you don't need to be one of them. And putting your phone away, I said that at a developers conference once, and People, I think, looked at me funny.
Hey, there's some weddings that I shoot where the reverend or whoever the officiant will say, like, oh, put your phone away. We've hired professional photographers and videographers, so you don't need to take your photos. It's just distracting and whatever. So
yeah. Sometimes it helps to just, and I, you know, for folks who are listening to this, you know, when you're done with the podcast here, when you're, you know, don't do it now, but when you're done with the podcast, put your phone away just for an hour and see what it feels like. It'll feel a little weird at first, but I guarantee you that after the hour is over, you can get a little bit more comfortable with it. And the more you can progress with that, it's really nice not having your phone with you 24/7.
I think the biggest pet peeve for me is like when I'm having a conversation with someone, right? And then like they're like somewhat like a little bit on their phone, their attention's on the phone, like that. Like I think when I realized what that made me feel, kind of made me more aware of what not to do towards other people. So, you know, just I think that all just falls under this thing of being present.
Yeah,
and not absolutely focus too much on anything else.
100%, 100%. It's almost like you're reading my mind here, because then my next question is, what's the one thing you do to escape and clear your mind from work?
What I do to escape and clear my mind? I do a couple things. Right now, it's really hard to do with a pandemic, right? But before, I used to like to travel, love to visit. I just did a road trip all the way from California to Washington and back on the Pacific Coast. We drove down the Pacific Coast. That was a lot of fun. But obviously with the pandemic... Yeah.
Recently with all the fire and all that?
Yeah, it was actually right before it happened.
Oh, wow.
As a matter of fact, we saw a little bit of it, and to the point where, you know, it looks like Blade Runner in the movie, 2040, the new one, where it was like all red outside. Part of the drive was like that, which is crazy. When we went, it was right before like the real major one that happened with the baby shower. Remember one? Yeah.
Yeah.
So I did that. I like to travel. I like to figure skate. That was like a new thing that I recently picked up. I became so interested in ice skating, and I was just so like baffled away with gobsmacked by seeing these like figure skaters in the little middle of the rink doing their own little twirls and stuff. And I was like, I really want to learn how to do that. So I got myself some figure skates, and I did that before COVID. So I like to do that when I wanted to step away. Can't do that anymore because the rinks are closed. But otherwise, just hanging out with my dog, you know, spend time with my dog. We go out to skate in our neighborhood. So
what's your dog's name?
His name is Kodak.
Hello, Kodak.
just like the my favorite film that I shoot. So.
Oh, nice. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Last question, Kento. Folks in our profession, they don't get a lot of opportunity to promote themselves. So here's a chance for some self-promotion. What about yourself are you most proud of, love the most, or something that you do that you use to inspire confidence in yourself?
I'm most proud of. I think the thing that I'm the most proud of about myself would probably have to be my tenacity on things. I don't know where the stamina comes from. I mean, the tenacity that I had to have to build that Smash Combos app, you know, in time for what, in 3 weeks that we, 2 or 3 weeks that we had when it was assigned. That was endless amounts of work, and it required me from getting up at like 7 a.m. in the morning to, I'll go on campus and I'll work there till sometimes 3 a.m. and then go drive home back to Tampa, drive back again to get there by 9, stay there for another 3. Like, it was just that constant, like, what I feel like I'm the most proud when I find something that I really like, I like give it everything I've got. And surprisingly, I haven't burnt out or anything. And if I do feel like I'm starting to burn out, I take a break and just relax and whatever. But I think my tenacity is like one of those things that I think has got me through a lot of things.
All right. Well, excellent. Excellent. Kento, I hope you had some fun hanging out today.
Had a ton of fun. Thank you so much for having me.
Excellent. For folks out there that are interested in hearing more from Kento, and remember, you should hire him if you're looking for a developer. You can follow him on Twitter at Kento Kawakami, and you can check out Smash Combos at smash-combos.rokuapp.com. I'll include links to these links and anything else that we talked about here in the show notes below. Thanks again, Kento. And thank you all for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. And if you're subscribed, I'd love to hear back from you. You can email me at hello@friendsthatcode.com. Constructive criticism is always the best criticism, or just tell me what kind of guests you'd like to hear from in the future. And with that, tell your friends, because next week we'll be back again with another amazing person that I know that just happens to write code for a living. Until then, be well, everyone.